off the ball rugby.
Ireland have proven time and time again, except for that one big match, that they can beat anyone on their day. So obviously what they're doing is very, very good. I'm just looking for that little 1.5% extra.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
Off the ball daily.
Now, my guest is two-time European indoors 400 metres champion David Gillick. When he landed that gold back in Madrid in 2005, I'm sure he's been told this a million times, Ireland's first sprint medal in over 70 years at that point, David.
Yeah, it was... it's mad when you think about it, you know. And like so much has happened since, but the initial moment of winning that medal, it was amazing. And again, you mentioned kind of sprint and a long time since we won a medal before. It was different and it was new, I think, in Irish athletics. We were known as a middle to long distance nation, definitely not a sprints nation. So to win a medal in a short event, I probably would like to think now maybe gave us a little bit of belief that we could compete, particularly at the European level, in the shorter events.
It's a pivotal moment in your life. We're talking about the race, which is your memoir looking back in your career and life after athletics, because, you know, to different listeners who are here now, they'll know you for different reasons. Some will be like, oh, I remember him on MasterChef. Yeah. Or they might well have bought a pair of shoes from you while you were a travelling shoe salesman at one point at the end of your career. Or perhaps I'd say for younger listeners particularly, they know you now as the guy in the TV who speaks to the athletes after races. So there's a lot of things going on.
It's funny. Not that I Google myself that often, but if I'm ever looking for results and you put in like David Gillick, it comes up to like, was David Gillick an athlete? on a drop down menu on Google. But look, it's funny, I can remember even the whole MasterChef. I remember being down in Dundrum soon after MasterChef, and a couple of older ladies, let's say, and they're kind of nudging each other and pointing, and they're like, are you the chef? And I was kind of like, well, I suppose so, yeah. It's been mad. It's been a bonkers journey, it really has. And to even like release a book at this point now, sometimes I pinch myself, and even going around the shops you kind of go, God, like, there it is on the shelves, you know. I never would have thought I would have put a book together. It wasn't something that I initially wanted to do. I think the journey of being on the track to now where I stand and kind of the post-race interviews has given me a completely different perspective of the sport, and indeed like kind of performances. And I can now see what a performance on the track does to people in the stands, particularly family and parents. And that makes me feel really proud that I gave my parents a couple of big days out and championships and little trips away. And I think that's probably something that maybe kind of just planted the seed of like, yeah, maybe it's time to maybe look back and put it in a book.
Is this why you've written the book now, given that we've come off the Olympic cycle, Paris felt very successful for Team Ireland, we've had European medals in recent times as well. Is that why we've got this kind of athletics boom at the moment?
Yeah, no, it is. I think for me, the big change was probably the Europeans in Munich 2022. And there's a couple of factors. When I look back, it was the first season that the GAA finished early. So kind of, there was not a whole lot going on in August. And then next minute, the athletic starts in Munich. And we had a really good championship. We had a lot of youth coming through. Adelecki, Olatunde, people like that were coming through and done well. They made finals. And suddenly it was primetime TV. And I can remember doing a couple of the interviews, and then there was a bit of reaction online to those interviews. And it just suddenly kind of, people were watching it. People had an interest. I came home and then people had questions. God, I saw that person. And to me, God, people were watching athletics. You know, the man on the street was watching athletics, which is fantastic. And I think that probably started something over the last couple of years. And then you mentioned Paris, and Paris was just fantastic. You know, it was brilliant. Again, prime time, so close to home. A lot of people tuned in, families. And to be trackside and have a role in that is an absolute privilege, particularly in the sport that, you know, I know well, and I've walked the walk up through that mix zone on plenty of down days. And I think that gave me a bit of insight into kind of how to prepare for the interviews and how to maybe, you know, showcase the sport, but also give context so people back home could kind of follow that journey and get an insight from the people on the track.
Does it help you to ask the questions as well? Because, you know, as a journalist who's end up in those situations in mix zones where, I remember one time Ciara McGeehan got injured and herself and the late Gerry Kiernan were having like a massive row just before she came through the mix zone. And you're thinking the last thing she wants to do is actually stop, but she feels compelled because she sees an Irish journalist who's standing in the spot and has been waiting a while for her to go by. It's very difficult for them to walk by because, as you know, as an athlete, they come through and they'll see the familiar faces and you have no option but to walk through the mix zone.
It's the only exit point in the stadium. And it is, like, I think there's a level of empathy there, there's a level of understanding. I think as well, body language is great. You know, when you watch on TV, okay, you only see certain shots, but when you're there, you see exactly what's happening and you can focus in on one individual and see their reaction when they cross the line. Therefore, that kind of gives you a bit of an insight. Okay, well, are they happy? Are they not happy? Because it's not all about a gold, silver and bronze. You know, someone could run a personal best. They could come, you know, make a final or just actually qualify for the actual games or the championship. So again, you have to kind of throw that all into the mix, because that will then kind of dictate, okay, well, what might they be feeling? And then I just, generally the way it works is, like, we're not the first person when they come off the track. You know, there's bigger broadcasters that kind of buy that space, so we're a little bit back, so you have a bit of time to kind of watch what they're doing. And then, look, words are like bullets. You know, I want them to talk to me. So again, I'm trying to be, you know, I'm trying to be a little bit warm, empathetic, show a level of understanding, and just, it's not about me, it's about them. So give them the opportunity to tell people back home what's happening. And I think in Tokyo, that really, for the Olympics in Tokyo, that really kind of struck a chord, because the stadium was empty. So friends and family couldn't travel. So I really kind of, you know...
You are the window for the viewer.
Exactly. And that's kind of what I tried to do, is give them the opportunity to talk to people back home.
Because I can, again, have sympathy with what happened to you at the end of Rashid Adeleke's final at the Olympics in Paris just gone. We've all been in this situation. So not to give away the story entirely, you end up getting a better spot because you're half hoping, okay, she could medal. She just finished fourth. You've jumped about 30 spots up the queue. And you end up in a situation where the equipment malfunctions.
And again, this was all very new to me. Like, the way it operates is you have a certain position in that mix zone, and then you kind of realise, well, a rival, let's say, is halfway down closer to the track. So we can't have that happen if she was to medal. So you're trying to prepare for that scenario. If
you're mindful, the BBC are ready to go.
The BBC, yeah, they're ready to go. They're further down. So we're thinking, if she gets a medal, well, then BBC are going to get the interview first. That's going to go out on Irish TV. We don't want that. So there was a bookable position next to the BBC, which was manned. So a crew from Olympic Broadcasting Services have the microphone, have the camera, all ready to go. So we booked that for literally that race. We land down, have a chat with BBC. They're like, yeah, no, if you go ahead, whatever happens, you take the interview first. So next minute, the race unfolds. She comes fourth. She comes up and we're closer to the track now. So she's right up pretty quick. And I start the interview. There's a static mic, so it's in a fixed position like this, whereas generally I'll be lollipopping, as they call, as you know. And yeah, she's not saying a whole lot. You know, she's trying to articulate what has just happened. And then I get a nudge on my elbow to get the microphone in. The microphone wasn't switched on. So you're kind of, all this is going on in your head. Look, you know what it's like. I've a producer in my ear. You know, I've got someone behind Rashida telling me to hurry up, because you only have her for, like, whatever it was, 60 seconds.
Back at base, they're under pressure because they're like, everyone in the country wants to see this interview.
They want it live. It's going straight back. And she's not really talking, you know. So, again, all of this stuff has gone through your head. And to be brutally honest, I thought she was going to walk. You know, I thought she was just going to go, no, I'm done. And I wouldn't have blamed her, because so much is happening. So we got the interview, and thankfully the audio was okay. And then she goes off to do a few more interviews. I go back up to my position, and then I get a call saying, we need to do it again. So I'm like, oh my God, I'm going to have to ask her again. So she comes back around and I'm like, Rashid, I'm really sorry, but can we do that again? And in fairness to her, she did. And you know what? Like, I think back to that moment. She's just come fourth in the Olympics. You know, she was gutted. She was absolutely devastated. And to kind of spend more time than she needed in the mix zone and give another interview after kind of, you know, saying it all already, I think that just speaks volume for her. And yeah, but that's live. That's been in the moment, as you well know. You kind of...
Because you know what? I wouldn't have had a clue as a viewer, because I remember we were about to go on air. That racing was just before 7 o'clock our time. And the interview happened just before we went on. So naturally, before we were into studio, we had the TV on outside. We were watching it. And we're kind of wondering, did he go back to re-interview her because she felt a bit uncomfortable the first time around, and maybe she wanted to speak again a second time? We would have had no clue it was actually a technical issue.
I know. And then, like, you know, social media, and it's like, oh, the audio's off and all this. And you're like, oh, if only I could explain what happens, you know? But that's the way the mix zone's raw, it's emotive, it's live, so you don't necessarily know what's going to happen or what mood an athlete's going to be in when they come off the track. You know, I've tried to interview Olympic medal winners, world record kind of breakers, and they've walked straight past me. You know, sometimes they just don't want to talk, and they don't want to talk. That's it. There's nothing you can do. I remember in the Olympics last year, Jakob Ingebrigtsen came fourth in the 1500 metres. And it was funny because people didn't want to talk to him. you know? So some people just going after like the top three. I saw him come up and I was like, oh, I'm going to jump on this. So he came over and he gave a great interview, very humble, just really open and honest. And then he went off. 2 days later, he comes back and he wins the 5K. Mm. And I was doing an interview as he was coming through the mix zone and I could see him coming up and I was kind of trying to hurry this interview to wrap it up because I wanted to speak to Jakob Ingebrigtsen. But I missed him. He walked past and I wrapped up that interview. He was probably about 10 metres past me and I just shouted. I just said, Jakob. And he turns around and I said, any chance? And he comes all the way back up and we did an interview. I was like, he's my favourite athlete.
The superstar, superstar, isn't he?
Superstar. He was great. He was brilliant.
Does that help you still feel connected to the sport? Because you would have had options here. You know, like when Ortiz came to you for doing this, I'm sure there was naturally, let's put Gaelic into a co-commentary position and you end up doing what Jesse Barr has been doing, I guess, you know, doing the analysis on the race, or you could have been the studio guy. But you decided to become the post-race interviewer.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. In fairness, I got various opportunities to do the various roles from co-com to, you know, studio pundit. And then I went to one championship where they asked me to do co-com and post-race. So I was up and down the stairs. And I enjoyed the interaction with the athletes a lot more. I enjoyed kind of being there and talking to them. It felt that I was very present. It was live and I just felt very more connected with them. But it took me a while to actually kind of grow into that role as well. I think there was an initial couple of years where I still wanted to be out there. I knew too many of the athletes. They're from my era. My coach was still heavily involved. My training partner was still running. And that was a bit strange because I still wanted to run. And it probably wasn't until, I remember Tom Barr and the Europeans got the bronze in Berlin. That was about 2018. And that was probably the first moment I actually felt really comfortable on that side of the track. And I kind of grew more into it. And that's where I kind of, from that perspective, I was like, you know what? I much prefer being here, being away and being kind of present in the athletic stadium and interacting with the athletes. So thankfully, that's the way it's kind of panned out. And the studio, there's enough Corkonians in the studio and the comms are all looked after, so I'm happy where I'm at.
Yeah, it's hard to break that, isn't it? We'll take you back. Let's go back to the start of the race then and to the book itself, because you know, you grew up in a reasonably sporty family. Your mum is now in the Basketball Ireland Hall of Fame at this stage. I presume naturally in a house of four, both parents being sport orientated, you were probably pushed to play everything, were you?
Yeah, we were given every opportunity in fairness. I look back now as a parent myself and my parents were like they were the taxi drivers, you know, they washed the kit, they brought us here, there and everywhere. And again, four kids in the house. So I can remember going to like my brother's GA soccer matches, my sister's basketball games. I remember going to my mum, she was still playing at the time. So sport was all over our house every weekend. And that was probably something that in my formative years I kinda just accepted, you know. Sport was part and parcel of life. And then slowly but surely, you know, the opportunity to do everything from GA to, I remember going down playing badminton down the end of the road in the sports hall, an athletics club at the end of my road, Ballinteer St. John's, Bradford Rovers, all that were all on our doorstep. You know, and I kind of look back now, like we were blessed with so many good volunteers that just gave their complete and utter time to kind of nurture young talent. And, you know, I was fortunate enough to have that running club so close. We're really good people. And then through my school years as well, Our Ladies Boys in Ballinteer over to St. Benilla's and Kilmacud. Again, sport was just like it was everywhere.
Because especially not everyone in Dublin has that on their doorstep. We've talked a few times about Dublin 8, you know, which is like one of the biggest growing communities in the whole country.
Yeah.
They've no green space whatsoever. You've got, you know, what is now Dundrum Athletics essentially on on the corner of the road. You've got Marley Park not too far from you as well. Like, you're blessed with these opportunities that maybe some kids in the city wouldn't have.
100%. And like, I think that's something that we probably need to kind of really value and try and get better at in terms of not just kind of the bricks and mortar facilities, but just open spaces, you know, where you can kick a ball around, you know, you can go for a run, just that general kind of access to green space, because you can do so much. And we're blessed now in my area to have an athletics track, which has been in the pipeline for like decades, but that's built. It's an amazing facility to have. But prior to that, it was just fields, you know. And again, Marley Park, like everything happened around Marley Park, from GA to soccer to running, it all happened there. And we were like truly blessed to have that on our doorstep. And even now with my own kids, we live in the area, like we're up in the park the whole time. And it's something that it's probably only now, I probably, like when I was younger, took it for granted. But now as a parent, to have that on your doorstep and, you know, an abundance of green space is like, it's a joy to just kind of let the kids go out onto the green and kick a ball for half an hour. You know, like other parents have put up goals in the local green, and there's boys and girls over there the whole time, and it's so pure that it's just giving kids the green space and the accessibility to just be active, never mind sport, but just be active. And I think that's something that you know, very fortunate to have on my doorstep growing up, and indeed my parents as well. I think, you know, when I saw them participate in sport, you know, when my dad was out doing a bit of hurling, mum basketball, I saw what it meant to them, and I saw how they enjoyed it. And even socially as well, like you mentioned my mum, like my mum was inducted into the Basketball Ireland Hall of Fame. She was on the first Irish women's basketball team back in the 70s. She was one of the founding members of the Dublin Ladies Basketball Board in the front room of her house. And I can remember going in with the cups of tea and stuff. When I think back, like, that's probably the formative years when it comes back to sports, you know, but it was brilliant.
You want to be a footballer. I mean, I presume basketball was probably an influence in the house as well. So why do you go athletics and not in that direction?
Well, yeah, I suppose, yeah, the dream was to play in the Premier League.
Most kids have that.
And then the long ball over the top, I'd leg it onto it, I'd round the keeper and bang in a goal. And then when you went up the levels of the leagues, then sweepers came into it. And I was like, oh no, I've got to try and beat a sweeper. I was okay at football, probably a little bit better at the GA. So the soccer was the first team to kind of go around 15, 16. And then GA kind of came in a big way. I mentioned St. Pernilla's and Kilmacud. So, you know, it was just...
That's a sporting behemoth.
Yeah, yeah. Part and parcel of the kind of ethos of the school. And we done really well. And that was where GA was kind of the mainstay in sport. But in the background was always running. And particularly cross country in Benildas, and then the pace came into it, which kind of I could see there was a value of that when I was on the pitch. So that kind of kept me in athletics. I wasn't winning a whole lot. I was probably a little bit of a late bloomer, but I kept involved in it because I could see that it was helping me on the pitch. And then kind of the big game changer was going to Jamaica for the World Juniors. As an under 20, I missed the qualification time by 0.4 of a second, but they sent a relay team. So I went over there as part of the 4x400 relay team, and that just blew my mind. You know, I was what, 18, pushing 19.
45,000 people in the stadium for the final.
45,000 people, because they love their athletics in Jamaica, and particularly their junior athletics. But they also had one of the greatest talents we've ever seen in the world of athletics, is Usain Bolt. So on the Saturday night, I'll never ever forget it. There was people literally climbing over the walls and over the gates, and they were all wearing their France 98 Jamaica tops, because Jamaica were in the World Cup. And it was just the whole country got behind. And again, Saturday night, the place is literally bouncing and everyone starts going, Bolt, Bolt, Bolt. It was just, you pinch yourself moment. And that was really the game changer. I remember coming back from those championships thinking, you know what, I want more of that.
And Joe, you said in the book, he wasn't maybe the most natural runner either.
Oh, he was a horrible runner.
That's so strange.
Yeah, he was hard. Like when you watch, he was gangly. He was tall, you know, really tall for his age. He had a right old arch in his back, and just kind of really raw. But God, could he move? Like the pace and the strength, like 200 meters around the bend, and he just took off up the home straight, and the whole place was erupting. And it was my first time seeing people of that level of talent. You know, it was the first time I saw someone run 10 flat, and I remember watching Darrell Brown from Trinidad, and never forget it. And he's just. It looks so easy, but yet covering the ground. And I think that, again, was just like, it was eye-opening in terms of where the sport could take you. And that was a catalyst for me then to kind of pack in all my other sport and begin to focus on athletics.
Yeah, because I suppose that's Usain. You know, we get used to him being so graceful. Like, if I think of him in Beijing particularly, it was almost like he glided across the track.
Yeah.
And I remember that shot where the thunder lightning was in the background and the rain. And, like, he's just... the grace actually catches you. It never felt like he was actually pushing himself all hard in any of his big races.
And that's the thing. I remember watching that race in particular, and there was another gear there. You know, but even going back to the junior, like, he was nervous. You could, like, behind the blocks. And if you ever get the opportunity to kind of watch it, you're almost going, how did this guy then transform himself into this confident and, you know, doing everything behind the blocks and, you know, engrossed in the crowd? But back then he was just a young, so raw, but you could see the talent, you could see the pace and the, you know, what he had at his disposal. But I think in time, like, he just grew to be kind of, he transcended sport, like.
Your own path then, am I right in saying it goes kind of cross country, 200, you go hurdling, and eventually you go to 400 metres. So how did you find 400 metres as your actual event?
Yeah, so the way it kind of works is, like, you know, when you're young, you tend to do a lot of different events. I even threw the shot put at one point, you know, you do everything. And then you kind of realise, and again, having a good coach with a good eye kind of sees, okay, like, he's more maybe endurance based, or he's more like, you know, speed lead base or maybe sits somewhere in the middle. So for me, I kind of fell into the middle. So you're looking at somewhere around, you know, at the time you kind of, you try 300 meters first and then you go to like 400 and then you might even move up to 800. I was probably sixth year in school, and that's where the first one I did was 400 meter hurdles. Because being tall and kind of like, you know, long-legged, you're looking at kind of stride length and stuff like that.
That's a monster of an event, though.
It is, yeah, it is. And I had good pace, but I my hurdling was crap.
Right,
I was like high jumping over it. I was terrible. But I won my first All-Ireland in the schools over 400 meter hurdles. So that kind of gave me something to kind of work with. It was like, you know, again, domestically and kind of in your school, you're coming back with an All-Ireland medal. It was brilliant. So that kind of gave me a bit of motivation to think, okay, the one lap is probably where I'm going to kind of fall into. And then the following year, focused on the 400 meter flat and done well that year. So I could see progression. And then that's kind of where I really began to focus. But at the same time, I never ruled anything else out. I never ruled out move up to 800. And even at one point later on in my career, you know, in 2009, I kind of said to my coach at the time, Nick, I was like, look, if I don't break 45 seconds this year, we're going to make a change. And that was either going to 400 meter hurdles or move up to 800. But I did break 45 that year, around 44. So that, again, put me on a different level. But naturally, you know, and for a lot of kids I coach locally in my club now, you're at a young age, let them do everything. And then you kind of nurture it, you see who's good at it, little kind of tests that you can do, you see who's got the engine, who's got more of the sprint-based kind of talent, and then you try and kind of nurture that into a various event.
Hey football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.
AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at Rubrik.com. That's Rubrik.com.
Because like 400 is a mix of both. So you're going to have to sprint at an incredible speed to get to 44 odd seconds.
Yeah, yeah.
And at the same time, it's much further than someone can sprint. Like we, Rashid Alecki's coach on last year, and he was talking about, you know, kind of getting her used to 400s. Yeah, and was saying she's kind of a natural 200.
Yeah,
she was like, she bursts out for the 200 and I need to have her having a little bit left in the tank for the last 200.
Yeah.
But it's a difficult thing to do because you're trying to do as quick a time as you possibly can.
Yeah, and that's where like the body can take over as well. You're trying to manage the body so it doesn't fall apart in the last 100 or even the last 50 meters of a four. So, you know, you're looking at that speed endurance. Thankfully, I was probably the type of athlete coming from maybe like a 600 to 400, whereas Rashida would be more of a 200 moving up to four. And that can be tricky because all you want to do is go off really fast, but then trying to maintain that in the hole, that can become really, really difficult. So you're trying to change things around a little bit where you work on the speed endurance. For me, one area that I kind of did try and improve later on in my career was that speed element to try and get a little bit faster. So therefore, then I could maybe cruise through the 200 a little bit easier and then have more left in the tank. So again, it's trying to find that kind of balance. For me, I was always a strong athlete. I could get through rounds, I could get through the slog of the training. I used to always think, why didn't I pick a different event? Why didn't I pick an easier event? Because the 400 is a killer, particularly the training, because there's no such kind of like easy days. You're always kind of hitting your lactic threshold because that's what you're trying to build and trying to maintain. So the more lactic that you can build in training and try and tolerate that, the further up the track you get.
There's two parts that kind of stood out for me. The first one was, especially later in your career, you're talking about how hard the recovery could be.
You
leave everything on the track after 400 meters and you were just shot when you get to the finish line. You were talking about like being on the track for ages even before you pick yourself up.
Yeah, there's like plenty of days. Tuesday was probably the worst day because that was a real, you know, speed endurance lactic session. It could be something like 6x300 off short recovery. So it's and that may not sound a whole lot, but trust me, you're hitting them at a really kind of fast pace. There's been days where maybe 40, 45 minutes, like literally scraped off the track You've depleted everything, you know, and that's what kind of pushes you further down the track, you know. But it is really, really hard, and that's the thing about 400. It's like every day you're kind of pushing the dial a little bit. There's no such kind of like easy sessions. You're always kind of hitting the body. That's what makes it as well, and mentally as well. You know, when you turn up for a race, you know you're going to be hurting in like 40 odd seconds. So having all that training done is that kind of confidence to go, okay, I'm ready for this.
The other side of it is it means that there's actually no break really, because you've written about the fact that you're training 5-6 days a week. Sunday might become your only off day, and then it becomes, I got to make recovery day actually count because I'm back to training tomorrow. So instead of actually getting to switch off, you're using Sunday as a day to prepare for another heavy load of work.
Yeah, and that was probably something, again, I probably let seep into me more than I really should have, you know. Like a rest day is an opportunity maybe to switch off from the sport and kind of chill out a little bit. Whereas, and I was good at that to a certain point, but then, you know, you begin to kind of see the times, you know, you're running faster, you want a little bit more, right? What can I do? You're looking for that point one, that point two. So rest and recovery became probably the secret weapon in many ways. So I'd look at a Sunday as a day to kind of ramp up my recovery ahead of Monday, you know? So like mentally, I probably wasn't giving myself the opportunity to switch off, but there was plenty of times where, like, you know, Charlotte, my now wife, she'd be like, oh, come on, we'll do something, go for a walk. And I'd be going, no, I can't be on the legs today. Like, she'd be going, God, you're so boring, you know. I'd sit in front of the TV all day on Saturday, watch Premier League or whatever it was, and just try and get off the feet, and try and eat and recover and go again on Monday, you know. Which, you know, when I look back, you make the best decisions you can in those moments, but I probably needed to just flick the off switch a little bit more.
Yeah, look, I think this book is as much about Charlotte as it is about you and your relationship. No. And I said to you just before we started, I mean, you've called it The Race, and that's a natural name for it. I would have been tempted to call it The Incident,
because
a load of the spicy chapters that are in there have the incident at the end of it, because they're usually, I guess, a tantrum from you with her in attendance, or your parents in the case of Barcelona when you were angry about them critiquing maybe your technique straight after a race. And now here you are having to talk to athletes straight after them anyway. But like when it comes to Charlotte's case, so I don't know, when I hear, like, definitely comes across as you could have been a difficult guy to live with at times.
Is that fair? Yeah, no, it is fair. 100% fair. I was difficult. And I think, but at the same time, I tried to just be the best professional I could be. I wanted to do everything at 100%, you know, and this kind of, which isn't the right way about it now, and I realised that, but like, I can remember late 2007, going into 2008, Olympic year, you know, it consumed me to the point where I remember getting a new iPod Nano, and they gave free engraving on the back. So I got that, and on the back,
I have to be perfect.
I have to be perfect. Everything I tried to do, and it was our first year going out with Charlotte, and like, you know, the honeymoon period, you want to do stuff, you want to go and, you know, go out and go to whatever it is, you know. I didn't do anything, you know. And then I can remember, like, you know, again, a couple of the incidents, the sweet potato incident, you know, losing the rag over an extra 50 grams of sweet potato in a Spanish omelette on a Saturday afternoon.
So you go back now and you think that frittata was fine, and I can deal with an extra few carbs here.
Like 50 grams of sweet potato, and it ruined our weekend. And I do kind of go, like, and I remember when I said to her I'm doing a book, she kind of put the head in the hands and went like, oh my God, are you really? And she goes, what are you going to say in it? And I was like, I'm going to just have to go all in. Like, and all these kind of memories and moments come back. And I wasn't the easiest person to live with, but I think Charlotte understood that. You know, she came from athletics as well. She was in Loughborough. That's how we met. She was there on a scholarship herself, you know, so she was talented and she understood what it was all about. And again, we had, like, you know, the same kind of social friends and social community where we were all in that kind of boat, you know. And I think, you know, she really understood what it meant, you know, whether it was 50 grams of sweet potato or whether it was a defeat or a bad time in a race, she understood that reaction. And again, patience of a saint, you know, because, you know, and that's the hard thing. I think we talk about sports people, but there's always people very close to those sports people who are trying to pick up the pieces a little bit and, you know, kind of manage them through the tough times, the defeats, the wins, success, all of those sort of things. And, you know, for me, she was that person. But yeah, like the highs and the incidents, like the toothpaste, the mattress, like there was, like when I was putting the book together, I actually turned to her and I was like, God, do I come out of this looking anyway good? Like, you know, but I think at the same time, like, it's important to be honest. And I think a lot of people who are trying to get the best out of themselves will can relate to that, and even people who are close to that person can relate to it as well. The highs are high and the lows can be low.
Mm. So a toothpaste incident then. This is where you pick up a tube for a toothpaste, you decide to fire it across the room, it eventually explodes.
Exploded.
And essentially you're here in a frustrated state because of how the Olympics have gone for you. This is just after your last race in
This was in
race.
Beijing.
Yeah,
this was in Beijing. And I'd put so much in to the Olympics, physically and mentally, and then it all just fell apart. It fell apart in the training camp, and I knew it. I knew in my last training session in a place called Matsui in Japan, it didn't feel right, and I didn't feel right. And I think as an athlete, you get very in tune with your body. You know how it's feeling. You know how what form it's in. And I knew after that session that something wasn't right. And but I didn't say anything to anybody. Again, that kind of alpha male, just get on with it. It'll be okay. Went into Beijing. Ran the slowest time of the year, came fourth in my heat, Olympics over in one run. And friends and family, I had three mates that cycled from Dublin all the way to Beijing. The only three guys to cycle around the world and put on weight, but that's a different story. There was all of that, and there was pressure as well. I think, you know, we're always looking for who's going to get a medal. It's the Olympic Games, who's going to get a medal? And
so there was a massive external pressure on you.
There was.
Because, well, five, you're a young man. You're 21, about to turn 22, I think. You defend your title in Birmingham. And we can talk about like indoors versus outdoors and all that.
But
the reality is that you were marked out then as a European champion. And therefore, there was this feeling that Gaelic is going to hit his mid-20s for Beijing. And a long way out, you were marked as, here's a guy who's at least going to get to the final of the 400s.
And even indoors, I'd ran 45.5 indoors. So straight away, people started going, oh, he's going
to
run.
Form.
Yeah. He's going to run 44s outdoors. Easy peasy. If he does that, he can make a final. If he does it in a final, he could win a medal. You know, it's very easy to say these things, harder to do it. And the reality was, it didn't happen for me, and I was devastated. And that's when, like, you know, friends and family, you know, they spent their good money to come over to Beijing. You know, they want to have a few drinks and all the rest of it. And then you're kind of like, oh, go along. But you're in no form for it. And essentially, that's where the toothpaste got it. Like, you know, they were staying in a hostel, and I can remember just so, it was the day after, and I was just so annoyed, and I was so fed up, and I was just so, can I say, pissed off?
Yeah, go on,
yeah. Yeah, I was properly pissed off. I was like, why does it have to happen now? And then I was angry at myself because I knew why. I put too much pressure on myself, you know, going back all the way to even October 07 when it all started. You're like, why did I behave like this? Why didn't I switch off a little bit more? Why didn't I do this? Why should I have done that? And just the anger and frustration. And unfortunately for her, like, because she's so close to me, like, she's the person that I felt I could vent and I could rant.
And you're a reasonably new couple at that point too, right?
Yeah, we were only together like probably less than a year. And I can remember just launching the toothpaste and it just exploded all over the wall.
At least it didn't hit her.
It didn't hit her, no, certainly didn't. But I do remember then silence, and she's kind of like almost against the wall looking at me going, what are you going to do next? And I remember kind of thinking, I need to calm down, like, you know.
Yeah.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger fuel centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.
AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at Rubrik.com. That's Rubrik.com.
Because see, I think a lot of that external pressure comes from a good place, some people too, because I presume there were probably loads of people who were aware of you as an athlete at a young age. Next thing you win a medal and you're on the news and you're on the telly and people are saying, wow, he's only 21 and now look at what the ceiling might be.
Yeah.
And naturally, and I remember, I think you wrote in the book that one of your neighbours said to you, oh, you're going to go win the Olympics now.
Yeah. I could imagine, like, it was mad. I remember coming home. And that was probably one key aspect of my whole career. I wasn't prepared for success. I was going into championships. Times were getting quicker. You come back with a gold medal. And I almost kind of naively thought, oh, it's just going to be the same. Mm. And it wasn't. And I was living at home. You know, I was in college in Dublin. Like, it was just normal. But yeah, people probably viewed me slightly different now.
So hold on now. You were saying before we came on, you probably didn't live the cleanest life when you were in college.
No, I was probably, I was hungover for every Friday for about 4 years. Like, I had all that fun and, you know, going out on student nights and stuff like that. And I probably didn't take the sport overly kind of seriously back then. And it probably took a medal like that to kind of go, oh, hang on a second, I actually have a bit of a talent. But suddenly the aftermath of that was like, you have to go to, like, you have to go up maybe 3 or 4 levels in terms of kind of my whole mindset. And then, like you mentioned, my neighbour, I can remember coming in going, oh, we knew you were good, but we didn't think you were that good, you know, and suddenly you're propelled into the limelight. And I think at that point in athletics in Ireland, you know, it was the end of the Sonia era. They were looking for, well, who's next? You know, who's the person that's going to come through now that we're going to pin all the hopes for? And then I win that medal and suddenly... I was that person, and I really struggled with that. I think, again, being young, being male, I didn't know how to deal with all of it. I remember going on the late, and then people were like, ah, Gaelic, you've made it. You know, I remember like going into Coppers around the corner and getting in VIP. And,
oh, gold cards.
You know,
yours?
People love that, you know. but again, it was just all a bit strange. And then, like, even the simple question of, like, what's next? Are you going to go to the Olympics? Are you going to win a medal? Are you going to win a gold medal? And you're kind of going, whoa, hang on. You know, this is just kind of, this is just... grow legs here, like,
you know, as a public, we're all guilty of it though, because I remember like when Ciara McGeen broke through, everyone went, here's Sonia's natural success.
Yeah,
we were just watching it happen, and that has impacted Ciara over the years too. Then she picks up an injury, misses the majors, and almost puts more pressure onto her then.
It's not
an easy thing to deal with.
It's not an easy thing to deal with, and I think with athletics as well, you don't have week in, week out championships. You know what I mean? You know, there's an awful long kind of build up to it. And that's when people kind of really have an interest and kind of you build it up. And then it all kind of comes down to that one race, you know, that one event. And it can be really hard for the individual to try and kind of disassociate themselves from that and focus on the job in hand. And that's a skill in itself. And that's probably where we've seen a lot more sports psychology come into performance across the board, which is great. But like, back then for me, like, that didn't exist.
Do you wish you had one now to
Yeah, definitely. Even simple things like dealing with the nerves, the doubts that we all have. You know, that probably came a little bit later on, but I think initially really struggling with everything, you know, even going down training and overanalyzing my training, and, well, if I want to run this time, I need to do my training this time, and just all of that began to kind of consume me. Like.
And like, I'm sure when you went to Loughborough University, education was part of it, but you're picking a school that has this reputation of being almost a finishing school for athletes.
Yeah, that's exactly what it was. Like, I was doing a master's, and like, it took me about 3 years to do it, but the main reason I went was to run. Yeah. And there was a good setup, a good coach, a good training group, in particular Martin Rooney, who I reference quite a lot in the book, because he was the person that I wanted to train with. He was faster than me. He was essentially better than me. And I kind of realised if I want to improve, I need to be challenged every single day. And, you know, Loughborough for me was, I remember someone recently saying, oh, if you could go back to any age of your life, what would you go back to? And I'd go back to, like, you know, 24, 25, 26, because I was very present. I knew exactly what I was after and what I was doing.
Were you enjoying your running at the time?
I was loving my running. Mm. Yeah, I loved it. I just loved the whole environment. I loved kind of, you know, I felt like a professional. I was getting up in the morning, I was having a good breakfast, I was going down training, you know, I had good kind of, I remember having a playlist and just been pumped going into training every day, and you're around kind of like-minded people. I remember the likes of Jess Ennis coming into training, people who'd won medals, and I'm in this environment and I'm watching what they're doing, and it was just complete another buzz. And they were great years, and I was challenged. Like, Rooney was such a phenomenal talent. You know, he was 4 years younger than me, broke Roger Black's 400 metre junior record, went, you know, made the final in Beijing. He was just so good. And he would challenge me every day. And we were great mates as well. I think the social element off the track as well was something that was of real importance. And they were just really happy years, you know.
And more importantly, you met your wife.
And I met Charlotte, yeah.
I want to take a very short break. We'll talk about doping. We'll chat about the end of your career when we come back in a sec. So David Gillick is still here with me. His memoir, The Race, is out and available in bookstores at the moment. You were mentioning Loughborough University, and it just reminded me of a story in the book, which was, I guess, one of those things that happens on the track when people are warming up and they're having a chat ahead of London 2012.
Yeah.
And it's like, wait a minute, didn't a lot of Greeks do well in that Olympics? And it doesn't seem that the home countries tend to do quite well. I mean, UK athletes did very well in London 2012.
They did very well.
But the discussion naturally comes around doping. And I think as your career went on, you probably became more aware of it. Is that because, like, athletes were getting pinged in your races?
Yeah. I think, to be honest, that was it. It's one of these things where you're very much focused on yourself and your own race, and, you know, you line up and it's kind of, you're going through your race plan. You're not really worried about other people, because in my race, I stay in my own lane, particularly in outdoors. So it's very much, David, just connect the dots here and look after yourself. as I got a little bit older, and there was always this kind of cloud of doping in athletics and, you know, the hearsay and people getting caught and stuff like that and getting bans. But it would never actually happen in my event. Mm. And that was a strange thing, you know, just never really. Like, even the Russians at the time, the Russian female 400-meter runners, were, they were just running ridiculous times, and then eventually they got all kind of busted for drugs. But it never happened in my event until 2009. And that was when, you know, you kind of get a little bit of a, hang on a second. And maybe I was a little bit naive, but that's when LeSean Merritt got done after Berlin. And
you know, it's not that I'd be annoyed. I think you were sixth in Berlin.
I was sixth.
You look up and there's like a couple of guys who've got done for doping at the top.
Yeah, and that was the big thing. Like, you know, necessarily I may not have won a medal in that race, but did I come fifth? Did I come fourth? Mm. Hang on, did I come third? You know, so these questions come in to your mind and you're going, well, if he's cheating, how many other people are cheating? You know, so then you kind of have these thoughts about, well, you know, who's clean and who's not. And I think that was probably the moment where, yeah, you began to kind of start having a few questions about different people and not only the different athletes, but their environments. And this is something that I think, you know, when we try and stamp out doping, I think there'll always be doping in athletics, unfortunately, and indeed high performance sport. But I think it's not solely just on the athlete. I think it's the wider people, agents, coaches. We've seen how systematic doping has been going on in various countries. So there's a wider kind of issue. But for me at the time, that's when it really kind of struck a chord, was off the back of 2009, when the winner gets busted for drugs. The guy in second place, there was an awful lot of issues over whereabouts. So there's potentially two. You're kind of going, well, where did I come fourth? You know, and that kind of stings a little bit, you know.
Did anyone ever offer you any performance enhancers? Because you were like, you were in a training camp in America where a few guys got caught as well.
Later on, I went out to Florida and I was in a group where subsequently a number of athletes in that group, now some in fairness had moved on to different groups. But yeah, I think about three of them got done for drugs. You
at
know?
The same time when they're going, oh, Marion Jones has ruined
I'll never forget
for
that day, yeah. And again, the context with this was Marion Jones had lied in a federal court. Mm. So that's why she ended up going to jail and she was released, and ESPN 30 from 30 did a doc. And this was big in America, and particularly on the track that we trained. A lot of people were talking about this, that's going to be aired. It was aired. We came down to the training the following day, and you know, some of the Americans being American, very kind of outspoken, and you know, using, jumping up and down and kind of, oh man, she robbed medals, she robbed money. And I'm thinking, oh my god, like, they feel really strong about doping here. And then later on, like, you know, a few of them people get busted for drugs and you're kind of going, hang on a second. It was a weird time, you know. And even off the back of that, you're kind of thinking, well, like, how clean is the sport? Mm. You know, who else? And you mentioned that kind of, by this stage then I'd moved back to Loughborough and 2012 was on the horizon, and we were training one day and, you know, you're warming up, just a bit of banter, a bit of chat, and then this topic came up about the Greeks. You know, God, didn't they do well? And, you know, the general belief was that maybe one or two had a free ride without getting tested. And then the kind of question was like, well, I wonder which British athlete might get a free ride, you know?
Is that as far as the conversations went? Because I always wonder, like, will you ever approach or did anyone ever come to you and go, here, I could get you EPO or I could get you something that might help you recover?
No, I'll be honest. No, that never happened. And no one ever came to me directly and offered me anything. I can't say that I knew where to go if I wanted to get it. Mm. I didn't. But you could probably figure it out.
Talk to someone who knows.
Very quickly, in terms of, okay, if you wanted to go down that path, or else, as we've seen in the past, you could easily do it yourself.
Yeah.
You know, it was never something that even came into my radar. It was never something that I thought I'll do this, or even kind of entered my brain. It just morally, I couldn't. I'd be cheating myself. I'd be cheating my sport. I'd be cheating my family, you know? And I think I just got too big morals to do that, you know? Yeah.
See, in a way, I can understand why some people go that way, purely because you've mentioned the money side to it, and that's what the Americans were concerned about, because everyone runs for medals, everyone runs to try and break records and so on, but the reality is that your funding is largely determined by what you do at majors. If you've got the suspicion that other people are doing it, and then an agent or a coach or someone else come by and go, look, here's something that might help you just shave a few tenths of a second off your speed, you could be very tempted to go, okay, this could set me up for life.
Yeah,
I'm not condoning what they do, but I can understand why some athletes think, well, if everyone else is doing it, maybe they're just open better than I am.
Again, I agree with you. I think, you know, like, athletics is a global sport, so people are coming from various, you know, walks of life, where if you can get a leg up and maybe get an education and then go on and compete and make money, it's not only your family or yourself, it could be your whole village. And this is actually the case in reality. So there might be a lot of pressure on you. And then you go to championship, maybe it doesn't happen for you. Then you could have someone in your circle who is feeding you these kind of messages of saying, oh, everyone else is on it. You know what, you won't get caught in this. And, you know, I think you're impressionable to a certain degree as an athlete because your emotions can be quite low at times and you're trying to figure things out and I need this, I need to find a performance. And again, I'm not condoning it one bit, but I think that's where I kind of reference there's a wider circle to doping. It's not necessarily just the athlete. There's agents, because if an athlete runs well, then the agent gets kickback, makes money. There's shoe deals, contracts, stuff like that. Meet promoters. Again, it's if you can get a world record on the track, you know, and it's on TV, you know, rating, sponsors, you know, and this is something that you have to look at from a doping perspective as well. It all comes into the one pot. And I think sometimes it falls back down on that individual who took the drugs, but yes, they have to be reprimanded, but also I think there's a wider issue around doping as well. But I completely think that at some times, yeah, you're very impressionable, you're looking for a performance with injuries, you may be trying to, you've lost sponsors, lost funding, you need to find something, and that could be the moment that you go down that slippery path.
So I have no interest in the enhanced games. For me, this is a bit of a freak show. This is the idea that you're almost going to use science to try and push the human body beyond where it should be. But about a month ago, I put up a tweet about the fact that Shane Ryan had gone to the enhanced games, and my big issue with Shane on it was he was retiring from swimming, that's fine. He used to be on the athlete council and he was very much on the anti-doping side. And I'm like, how can he get to a position where he's going to inject himself now with drugs to try and perform faster in the pool? He DM'd me and eventually came on chat to Owen here on the show for about half an hour, and he explained the situation, which was, I was on minimum wage when I came over here to swim for Ireland. Yeah. I came over from America, I wasn't earning much, it took a long time for my funding to kick in. Even when I was an Olympian, my funding wasn't exactly hectic. I'm not set up for life. The reality is some of his old university trainers are now involved in the enhanced games, and he knows a load of guys who are swimming. And it's like, these guys are going to pay me six figures, they're going to pay me to stay in LA, they're going to be the best medical treatment whatsoever. And I just, at this stage of my life, couldn't say no to it.
I listened to it, yeah. And in fairness, look, I don't condone what he's doing. I'm not a big fan of the enhanced games. I think we live in a world now where, like, you know, in the past, a marathon was the pure test of endurance. And now it's like, how many marathons can you do? It just keeps getting bigger and bigger. And now it's like, okay, well, like, you can run such and such. Well, if we give you drugs, how fast can you actually run? And it's all gone a bit crazy. What's disappointed me with Shane, and look, you know, if that's his decision, that's his decision. But I think at the same time, it's like, you know, do you really need to do it? You know, but then on the flip side, and I'll be honest, I retired from sport and I didn't have a clue what I was going to do. I had no money, I had no job. Was I worried? I was scared. And again, I'm not condoning it, but I can see why if someone came along and offered me six figures, something that could arguably changed my life in that moment, more money than I've ever made in my entire life through my sport, you'd have to think about it, you know. And I think that's me being honest. I would think about it. I'd like to say I wouldn't go through with it, because I think morally, from where I came from in the sport, it just wouldn't sit well with me. But I can see why he's gone down that path, and if that's what he wants to do, that's what he wants to do. But I think as well, it's like, it's a message it sends out to the next generation and to kids, and, you know, the enhanced games, what is it? Oh, it's about taking drugs and seeing how far you can push your body. Like, what are the long-term effects of that? You know, is it going to be in a supervised situation where you're...
Listen, there also the possibility it normalises the use. So if they turn around, because they say they're going to give out the data on all this, and they can prove, right, well, I've been given human growth hormone to an athlete, it's enhanced their performance, their recovery is improved, it's FDA approved, which they're kind of pointing out all the time as well. They go, well, why don't we just let all athletes have it?
Yeah.
Next thing, it becomes normalised, everyone's using it.
Yeah, yeah. And my worry with this is how big, people will tune in and watch this.
Of course.
You know, so therefore, if it makes big money, you could have the next generation kind of going, well, do you know what, I can actually make more money in the enhanced games. You know, I look after myself, I'll go and do that. So again, it's like, it's where, like the kind of, the big brother effect. People will want to watch this, and there'll be documentaries spinning off this and following the athletes. Therefore, then there's more money and revenue on that side of the sport. Is it going to take away from the true sport? And where does that leave everything else? And I think you're right. I think it does kind of, it's given it a massive shop window, which isn't right. I don't want my kids growing up going, hey, daddy, I'm going to go off and do the enhanced games and take a load of drugs and see how fast I can run. You know, no. No, do I want you, I want to see how you can do it for yourself.
Do you think about your own kids following your footsteps? Because you were saying that your son went as you on Halloween.
Yeah, it was book week. It's only a couple of weeks ago. And he goes, we're like, who are we going to go in as? And I thought, like, David Attenborough, because he loves all that stuff. Yeah. And he goes, I'm going to go as you. And I was like, what? And he went off anyway, came back with, like, he found an old vest and Gillick, the number. He put the spikes around his shoulders and a medal. And, like, in fairness, I'm kind of going, well, fair play, he came up with it himself, you know. It did kind of get me thinking about my own. So, and I get this question a lot, like, would I like my kids to do athletics? Initially, I would have said no. And that's the honest, I would have said no, because I didn't enjoy the end of my career, you know. I didn't enjoy what came after it initially. And I think the reality was that, you know, it caused me a lot of pain and a lot of hurt. Whereas now, I think with time, I look back now at my career and I'm like, you know, how lucky was I? Mm. You know, to travel the world, I met my wife through it, great friends, the experiences, the moments, you know, the good moments, all of those sort of things came from me pursuing a career in athletics and following a talent when I was a kid. And if my kids want to do that in any sport or any walk of life, well, like, I'll support them 100%. And like, that's why one of the reasons to kind of, I did the book as well. You know, it's not just about my kids, but I coach now locally and I see how young kids get nervous and stuff like that. And, you know, they have the little doubts and they probably don't realize how good they are. And I was that kid. And I think the more we talk about that, and the more we share our experiences, hopefully it might inspire one person to stick at their sport and maybe be a little bit more open and honest and ask for that help and advice. Because if I can help my own kids in that space, and it's not even about going to the Olympics or anything like that, it's more just if they can continue doing sport through their teenage years to adulthood, well, then that's a win. Like
The mattress incident probably sums up 2012 and retirement all in one go.
Because
you're talking about, like, injury, then recurring injury that will eventually lead to retirement. So if people wonder what the mattress is, not to give too much away here, you guys didn't even buy a bed when you went to Australia. No. You were sleeping on a mattress. And Charlotte had all of the clothes laid out, done all that dirty work, which is the ironing and everything else, probably in the heat of Australia. It's all sitting there neatly.
Yeah.
And David Gillick is annoyed because he's got injured and he flips them all over.
Yeah, it was. I did a great session that day as well. I was preparing for a race in Japan and the last rep of that session I twinged my Achilles and I knew it was bad. And I can remember then a couple of weeks and probably nearly 2 months, I'd say, trying to rehab it, and it just couldn't get back. And on one day on the side of the track, I just said, you know what, I'm done with this. And and I was initially all right, you know, and then I went home and then the reality. And I can remember walking into the room, and again, we were only there for a year, so we just bought the mattress. Didn't need the bed, just a mattress. And I had essentially a tantrum, and everything just went up. The mattress, the whole shebang. And then it all crashes down. And I can remember again, Charlotte kind of looking at me, and she's like, I'm not cleaning that up. And that was the start of my post-athletic life. And it was everything, you know. By this point, I'd lost funding, I'd lost sponsors, and you kind of have that optimism of, like, I'll get back on track.
I got the feeling this was last chance saloon for you.
It was, yeah. I was 30 and I was beginning to kind of think about, well, what am I going to do with the rest of my life? You know, what am I going to do next? And, you know, begin looking at kind of careers and jobs. And then also, like, by this stage now, we're in a long-term relationship. I wanted to get married. We wanted to start a family. And all of these things, you're kind of thinking, well, how am I going to do this? Mm-hmm. I don't have a job. I have nothing. And that was the harsh reality of how I felt. So it was a number of kind of things came in that moment. And I think as well, I tried so much. You know, I got injured in Florida. I came back, you know, got injured again. Miss London, I'll give it another go. It was just that emotional turmoil of trying to kind of be as resilient as you can, get over an injury, come back, and then it happens again. And that was just the final straw. So that was the mattress up in the air and all the fresh, cleanly folded clothes all over the room. And then picking it all up.
And the idea of you coming back and being in your parents' box room when you get back home.
Yeah, yeah. And the only reason I did that was because I got asked to do Celebrity MasterChef.
Right.
You know, I'd no real desire to come home. And again, it was all these kind of questions about, well, where we go? We go back to the UK, we go back to Charlotte's from England, we go back to England, go back to, you know, up to Sunderland where she's from, or, you know, what do I do for the job? And then I got an email about doing MasterChef. All right, yeah, I'm doing nothing else. Came home, she stayed in Australia. I ended up kind of doing MasterChef and winning it. And then it was like, okay, this is a moment. All right, I got to exploit this. I got to use this. Again, pressure. you know, I got David. This is the silver lining now. You know, you've got to jump on this.
Because you had said you'll try anything. It's almost like I need to find something to redefine me. I'm going to be successful at X, Y, or Z, wherever it's going to be. I need to find something.
And I was searching as well. I needed something to fill that void. And then MasterChef came. I was at home. Charlotte was still in Australia. And then September, I can remember waking up one day and just going, well, what do I do now? You know, I don't need to be anywhere. I've no job. I'm not running. What do I do? And then the kind of harsh reality, and it was always around this time of the year when the leaves change, you know, because that's when I'd usually go back training. And I can remember being in touch with a few of my training group and they're all getting stuck back in. And you're in that WhatsApp group, you know, they're all going back training and I'm not. Mm. And that's when the kind of penny kind of dropped. And I was like, well, what do I do now?
Travelling shoe salesman was never part of the plan.
Well, I panicked and I took the first job that came my way, which was working for a sports brand. And I was by myself because my direct manager and team are based over in the UK, which is probably in hindsight the worst thing I could have done because I was just by myself. And I was travelling the length and breadth of the country by myself, flogging trainers, you know. And again, the MasterChef, I had a funny one where they were like, oh, maybe we could do an event, you know, you could cook something. And we might flog a few trainers. And it was in Limerick on a really wet winter's night. And I remember a handful of people, I'd say, in the place. It was like a rural kind of sports shop. And flipping a few pancakes, it was oat-based pancakes. And that was it, hopping in the car and then driving 2.5 hours home. And you're just thinking, how have I got here? Like, you know, I remember going into another place in Dublin. And probably like a real running store, you know. And went in, there was a fella in there, and he literally looks at me, hey, Gillick, what are you doing here? And I was like, oh, I work for such and such. And he was like, what? But you were on 44 seconds. What are you doing this crap for? And I remember just, I had no answer. I had absolutely no answer. And then you get back in the car, and you're kind of thinking, like, what? Like,
does that hit you to the core? Because for a lot of us outside, you're kind of thinking, he's been successful on the track.
Yeah,
he
must be still it does.
He doesn't need to do this.
That day it did. I can remember the car was parked in the underground car park, and I remember just sitting in the car and just kind of going, "Is like, do they think I'm a failure now?"
Mm.
And that was the hardest part, because I think I tasted success in sport and I put an awful lot of pressure on myself that the next phase of my life had to be at that level, and if it wasn't, I was a failure. And that's how black and white it was. And I used to go on social media, and you know, a lot of rugby players who had retired about that time had gone on in businesses and stuff like that. I remember kind of going, why aren't I doing this? You know, you're an idiot, David. You've missed the opportunity. And I panicked, and like, then you just think, oh, this is like, I hate athletics because it put me in the situation I am now. Like, I resented my whole career, you know, and that's when things kind of just went a little bit dark, you know. Never happy, always just stressed, always wanting more, always searching for something. So, you know, even off the back of MasterChef, I'd start doing things at weekends, various gigs, any opportunity, I'll do that. It was Monday to Sunday. And it wasn't because I wanted money or anything like that. It was like I was trying to find something that was going to fill that void. And I couldn't find it. And that just went on and on. The weeks turned into months. And then it was like, you hear about this transition phase. And I kept saying, oh, it's just a phase. But I wasn't talking. I wasn't doing any form of exercise. And it was just a horrible time. I couldn't sleep. I had insomnia. I broke out in psoriasis all over my body due to stress. And I can remember then trying to be the healthy guru, you know, off MasterChef and eating kind of quinoa and all and quinoa and all these sort of things. But the harsh reality was I was binge eating, couldn't sleep. I was just ratty, irritable. And again, Charlotte got the brunt of it, you know. You know, I'd put the mask on, leave the house and be that person that I thought I should be. And then I'd come home. And I always remember the fatigue of trying to be someone you're not. Like the battle in my own head, the two voices going at it constantly. And then just coming home and just like literally falling in the door and then taking it all out on her, like, you know.
2016, you pick up the phone to essentially a neighbour of yours in Richie Sadlier, which is kind of what leads to you going to get help and to get counselling. Why did you wait so long if you knew that you were in such a dark place, or were you aware that you were there at the time?
I was aware, yeah. I knew because I stopped going out. I didn't want to be around friends or family. I began to really kind of isolate myself. Never happy. And things got worse then because like Sundays, panic attacks started kind of to really come to the fore because I dreaded Mondays. I dreaded the week. I absolutely dreaded the week. I just wasn't happy at all. And then I think the big catalyst was we got married in 2014, then we were expecting baby number one in early 2016. And that's kind of when, in my own head, I began to kind of realise I can't cope. I just simply, like, how am I going to be a dad? How am I going to be, you know, a good parent, a good husband? You know, I literally can't cope. And I was at an event the first fortnight, the first 2 weeks of January, to do various events around the city, and I was at an event, and Richie spoke, and I remember just sitting there, and I grew up in the same area as Richie, and, you know, I've seen him out and about, and he was really honest on that talk, and I never would have known that was going on. And that was kind of something that just always stuck with me. And I can remember chatting to him afterwards, and then I went on my way, he went on his way. And that day, kind of late 2015, when I rang him, and he said, come on down for a cup of tea, and I went down. And the first thing he said to me goes, you know what, like, I remember that evening when we said goodbye, and he said, I remember kind of walking off, and I just, Richie thought to himself, I wonder how he's going to do now. And that was kind of the first conversation I had with someone where I was just really just honest, you know, and just said, I'm struggling, like, I just don't want to be here, like.
And then so you can cancel now?
Yeah.
Same frequency, less, or?
Every second to third week now. Okay. So 2016, I started going cancel every week. And it's one of the best things I've done, it's nearly 10 years ago, you know. And I say it with a bit of a smile because, like, 10 years. And it was only, I only realised that recently, you know, because it seems so normal now that I go and I have a conversation with someone and I come out and I feel a lot better about myself. And, you know, I've probably taken that weight off my shoulders of whatever that is. And it was something that I felt very uncomfortable at the very start. And then over time, I began to look forward to it. It was like going for a run or going to the gym, you know. And again, it was that therapy that I needed. And I began making sense of who I was and began making sense of my journey and kind of why I was feeling and acting and behaving a certain way. And, you know, then you begin to realise, okay, well, like, I'm catching those little triggers before it all descends into chaos, and doing simple things that can actually help me and keep me on the straight and narrow. And a lot of them are practical things that I enjoy doing. Like, I like to sleep, I like to eat, I like to exercise, you know. And when I keep those in check, I feel better about myself, and as a result of that, I'm a better husband, I'm a better parent.
I feel it's given you a bit of peace. So I remember I was involved with the podcast Eric Donovan a few years ago that you did back in 21, and he talked to you about the Olympic experience, and you said, I'm not getting the tattoo
rings,
done. You wait for ages to get them done.
I did. Like,
that's the first thing an athlete does. They get home and they book in the session.
Yeah, I didn't. It took me 9 years to get them. I just felt I didn't deserve them. Like, I was very hard on myself, and I think when you read the book, you'll see, like, God, you know, you're really critical of myself, and like, but that's the way I was. I often think back and go, well, maybe if I was a little bit chilled, would I have ran better, ran faster? I don't know, but like, that's the decisions I make at those times, you know. And I felt after Beijing, I didn't run well. I don't deserve them. I'll get them in London. I'll get them in Rio, you know, because this was the plan. I never made any of them, and it wasn't until 2017, Charlotte for my birthday got me a voucher. And she said, you deserve them. And she was right. And, you know, I look at the rings now and again. We were away over midterm and, you know, in a T-shirt, and you see them and you kind of go, yeah, you know what, like, that's something to be proud of. And I think that's the thing that probably the role that I do now in trackside, I see what it means. I see what it means to the athletes. I see what it means to people in the stands, the parents, the friends, the people who are on that journey, the coaches, the whole support crew. And I see what it means. And, you know, that's when I kind of realised, you know what, David, you deserve them. You know, you put on, it was a dream as a little kid, you know, to go to Olympic Games, and I achieved that. And it's something to be very proud of. And, like, that's the thing with my own kids. Like, you know, if you have a dream, go at it, you know, lean into it and see what happens, you know.
Counselling put you back running again as well.
It did, yeah. I remember he was kind of saying to me, would you not go back, go for a run? I was like, no.
And then I associate with elite performance.
Exactly.
And
yeah, and also with myself, I had to better myself. I always had to improve. And slowly but surely I began to realise, you know what, just go out and run. And it all started by going and doing a park run. In Marley Park, and that green space that I was so grateful to have as a kid. And, you know, going up there, and I've often told the story about walking in, and first fella that came up to me was like, oh, Gillick, great, you should win this. And I remember thinking, oh God. And then they gave the kind of briefing, and local Olympian, then the ego kind of kicks in a bit, I'm going, oh, I better put on a show. And a 5K, you know, like, it's a lot different than running 400 metres. So I nailed the first K, took off, and then I died a thousand deaths. People passed me, a Labrador buggy passed me, but I finished it and I was out in a kind of green space, and I felt good. And that was, and again, Charlotte was with me, went for a coffee, and I can remember just saying, you know what, yeah, look, actually kind of enjoyed that. And then got back into it a little bit more and got back into running in a big way, and even recently did the Dublin Marathon.
I was going to say,
that,
this is my last question to you. How did the Dublin Marathon go for you in the rain a couple of weeks ago?
It was good, actually. Very busy, because I had the book was out a couple of days prior, and I was on my feet an awful lot that week doing the circuit. And I just said to myself, you know what, David, just start it. Go with the 3:10 pacer and see how you feel. And that's exactly what I did, and I landed at 3:08, and I was very, very happy. It was tough conditions, but do you know what? Like, not putting that pressure of trying to run sub-3 like I did 2 years prior, it was great to just... And look, Dublin comes alive. Mm. It's one of the best days in the city. So many people out and about and high-fiving kids and, you know, oranges and Jaffa cakes and all the good stuff. I really enjoyed it, and that, for me... is something that I need. I need a goal. I need something to work towards. And I need the structure and I need the routine. And running gives me that. It also gives me therapy. I love going out and just kind of running. And even a day like today, it's brilliant out there at this time of the year with the colours and the sun and stuff like that. And even that kind of chill factor to it as well. You feel like you've worked. And that for me is therapy in itself.
I'm glad to hear that you're back enjoying it again. Best luck with the race and just finishing off the circuit before Christmas and getting as many souls as you can. And thanks a million for dropping in.
Thanks for having me.
Off the Ball Daily.